I'll be off here. It would seem we might be. Well, in that case, let's begin. The bell's going to ring in the middle of our refuge and precepts. Okay, if you'd please join me. Namatasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammha Sambuddhasa. Namatasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammha Sambuddhasa. Namatasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammha Sambuddhasa. Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. This completes the three references. Now do the ten precepts. Panyatipada Rani Sakatadam Sundari Rani Adinadana Rani Sakatadam Sundari Rani Kamesu Nichachara Rani Sakatadam Sundari Rani Musa Vada Rani Sakatadam Sundari Rani Sura Maria Maja Pavarakana Ramani Sikapadam Samadhyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from sources of livelihood that bring harm to other beings. I undertake the precept to refrain from acting out of ill will or taking satisfaction in the misfortune of others. I undertake the precept to be open-hearted and generous in all my relationships with others. I undertake the precept to act with loving kindness and compassion in all my relationships with others. I undertake the precept to live with mindfulness
and follow the Eightfold Path through daily study, meditation, and reflection.
This completes the ten precepts. With these ten precepts, virtue becomes the vehicle for a happy existence. Through virtue, good fortune is attained. Virtue is the vehicle for liberation. Let us purify our virtue. We dedicate the merit accumulated here today to the benefit of all beings. By this deed, may all beings come to know the pure world, free from suffering. If you please join me, may all beings be free from suffering. May all beings be free from ill will. May all beings be filled with loving kindness. May all beings be free from suffering. Thank you. So how is everyone this evening? I hope you had a good day meditation. I hope I have more energy tonight. A little bit sluggish, but sometimes that goes away. No, I... tell you something interesting. I found it interesting, and you might. And that's last night. I was quite fatigued last night. And as we were going along, I was mindful of the fact that sometimes as I was talking, I would lose the thread of what I was saying. And I was also mindful of the fact that sometimes when I was answering somebody's question, sometimes
sometimes I didn't really answer the questions. You know, and I apologize for that. But that's one of those things that happens when the body's fatigued, you know, the brain, the mind, things just don't work quite as well. And have you ever had those experiences where you have your back and you're watching yourself and you just don't remember where you were going, but you try to pick up the thread and carry on. And that was happening to me last night. And so, you know, and there's a few things that I said that afterwards I realized weren't quite right. Like using the word fruition when I was talking about the consequences of karma, it's actually ripening is what Rupaka means. And those are subtle differences and they don't really matter, but they kind of stuck out of my memory. So by the time we were finishing up last night, I was thinking, boy, that was one of the worst discussions I've done in a long time. But at the same time, there's something that I've learned. You know, I tried to make myself just a conduit for things to go through me. And for the knowledge, for the wisdom of thousands of years of all of the people who practiced this Dharma, practiced it in Thai. And like last night, I felt a little bit cut off from that, because sometimes as I was speaking, I just heard myself saying things that I'd said before, you know, and it lacks that sort of, that spark of spirit of being totally present. And so reflecting last night before I went to sleep, I thought, yeah, that was one of the worst talks I've heard in a long time. But here's the other thing that I've seen it over and over again, that somehow or another, people hear what they need to hear, and sometimes I don't even know that I've said it until somebody comes up to me afterwards and they say, that was so great, you said this, it was exactly what I needed to hear. Oh, wow, that's so good. And I actually had that experience a few times today, several times today in meditation interviews, as people said to me, you know, what you said last night was, oh, good. So, anyway, I'm going to... the other thing that went through my mind, too, with the help of my wonderful partner, is just kind of like, why it is I have enough mindfulness to know what's going on. I don't have quite enough mindfulness to say, okay, I'm out of the top of my game. We're going to cut it short tonight and I'm going to go get some rest. I never do that. I never do that. I keep trying to persevere and carry on and do the job, even when I sense that it's not going as well as it could. So, I think it's going to be better tonight. I hope so. Yeah.
Too nice. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling on the whole pretty good, but I hit kind of a low energy point about 20 minutes ago, and I'm hoping that that's going to all dissipate very quickly. Thanks for asking. Appreciate that. All right. So there's a few questions, written questions that I received that are really more Dharma discussion topics than they are strictly meditation topics. And so I might just start off this evening with answering some of those questions. So one person asked, some people say that meditation is the least of the six perfections. Other folks say all six perfections are equal, and perfecting any one of them requires perfecting the other five. And I'm surprised. I didn't know anybody would rate meditation as the least of the perfections. It would be quite surprising. And certainly, I would have to say that, yeah, they work together. They're all equally important, and they're more or less inseparable. I mean, you can't achieve the perfection of meditation without the perfection of virtue and generosity and patience and right effort. And they all work together. They're pretty much inseparable. And to try to rate one as being more important than the other, maybe that was somebody who had trouble with meditation then. And it's very unfortunate they had trouble with meditation, and I hope that that's a thing of the past. But yeah, they certainly all need to go together. I won't read the whole thing, but one of the things was that there was a suggestion that the most important perfection of all was the perfection of wisdom. And then, of course, there's the suggestion that you, that meditation and wisdom are closely linked. They are very closely linked. They really are. And this is how, in the vast majority of cases of people who achieve the perfection of wisdom, they've achieved the perfection of wisdom through meditation. And I say the vast majority because there are those accounts that we have of people who have achieved the perfection of wisdom with little or no meditation practice, formal meditation practice. Although we have to wonder about their states of mind and how they were cultivated, and that something very similar must have been accomplished in order to make possible that perfection of wisdom. But what makes, you know, of all the spiritual traditions of the world, to me what makes the Buddhist tradition stand out is that it is such a highly integrated and systematic system that works across an enormously broad spectrum of people and works with a very high degree of consistency. When we look at other traditions and the mystical aspect of what you might call the highest attainments of a religious tradition, a spiritual wisdom tradition, I don't know of anyone that has demonstrated consistently over many, many centuries the high degree of success, and that has been transplanted from one culture to another and continues to generate the high degree of success. And I think that that is because the way it has been formulated covers all the bases, so to speak. Meditation is certainly an absolutely essential one. The other thing about the perfection of wisdom is that, well, if we just look at the Eightfold Path for a moment, the Eightfold Path is usually divided into wisdom, virtue, and meditation. Those are the three divisions of the Eightfold Path. And actually, you can see that the six perfections line up with the Eightfold Path in a similar manner. But when you discuss the Eightfold Path, it's usually pointed out that wisdom is at both the beginning and the end of the path. You need a certain degree of understanding to even undertake this practice. You need a certain degree of understanding to succeed in following the Eightfold Path successfully. And so it's definitely at the beginning, but it's also at the end, because wisdom comes in two forms. There is that understanding that is intellectual, that is really worldly, that sets us on the path, that aspect of understanding that's, you know, what all the teaching processes are about. But then there is the transcendental wisdom. There's the supramundane wisdom. There's the wisdom that comes through the experiential realization of ultimate truth. And that's the real wisdom. And all of the earlier wisdom teachings are attempts to create verbal and conceptual models that point in the direction of the wisdom teaching. More than anything else, what joins the early wisdom teachings of that come from study and analysis and so forth to the transcendental realization is the practice of meditation. So it ties them together. But at the same time, that doesn't put any other aspect of the Eightfold Path or any of the other of the six perfections into a lesser category. You know, they're all absolutely essential. I usually describe the Eightfold Path as being more like a cable with eight strands, and all eight are required, you know, twisted together to give it its strength. And it would not be the same with any one of those strands missing. And there's no one that's really lesser than the other. So that's my thoughts on the six perfections. And the perfection of wisdom and the perfection of meditation. Anybody else have any thoughts that they'd like to share or comments they'd like to make? Let's see what else we have here. Here's kind of a theoretical one about the mind. I've usually heard agitation and dullness explained like opposite ends of a spectrum, but can't they occur simultaneously too? I find I'm more prone to mind wandering and forgetting if my mind is low energy, dull, and so the guardians and watchmen are slack. It takes longer to catch a distraction. Could this be accurate? Yeah, that's very accurate. It's a very accurate way of describing it. Now, yes, they're not opposite ends of the spectrum. Dullness is the opposite end of the spectrum from the highest degree of mindfulness that you could possibly have. That is one spectrum. Agitation is a different phenomenon. Well, depending on what you mean by agitation, it could be more than one different phenomena. In meditation, very often when somebody says agitation, what they're referring to is how many different kinds of distractions that they're contending with at once. You know, we tend to say we're agitated when staying on the meditation object is especially difficult because there are so many distractions. Just the sheer number and the strength of them. A lot of them are really quite strong. And so we would describe our mind as in an agitated state. But that's really a different phenomenon than being less dull. The only relationship between them is, as I was saying this afternoon, a certain amount of dullness reduces the agitation, because essentially what it does is reduce the number of moments of consciousness that are available to be occupied by distraction, right? And so it does have that effect. And when your mind is agitated, it's true that there are a lot of moments of consciousness that have various different distractions as their object. But it isn't necessarily that many more total number of moments of consciousness per unit of time as compared to when you're not agitated. And as a matter of fact, when you're in a state of very great clarity, powerful mindfulness, single point of concentration, you have an extremely high number of perceiving moments of consciousness per unit of time. The difference is that they're all on the same object of attention. Actually, many of them have as their object awareness, particularly introspective awareness, metacognitive introspective awareness. What makes that high energy state of the mind different from agitation is the content of the moments of consciousness. It's that many of those moments of consciousness aren't occupied by distraction. So that particular sense of the word agitation is something that it doesn't lie on a spectrum with dullness. And the two can exist together, because as I said, we start out somewhere middle to lower end of the spectrum of what we're capable of in terms of perceiving moments of consciousness. And you don't really need to move out of that zone in order to have a high proportion of them being occupied by distractions. Right? Makes sense to you? Which, that's where these graphics would come in handy. You know, show you the visual graphic of, like a string of beads, all these moments of consciousness. Half of them are perceiving moments, half of them are empty, they don't have any object. And of those that have an object, we've got the situation where a high proportion of them are just your meditation object and appropriate peripheral awareness, and the other case where a high proportion of them are other distractions that are objects of moments of attention. And as this person said they found in their experience, dullness makes you very vulnerable to distraction. And I think you probably all had that experience. When you're a bit dull, yeah, the guardians are gone. The watchmen are not there. You don't have the peripheral awareness to warn you that you're about to succumb, that you're about to forget, you're about to be carried away by some attractive distraction. So, any thoughts on that one? Okay.
What about if you have nice stability, there's a quality of seeing that's a little, like you drink lots of coffee, or like if you were to like look at the coffee in your eyes, there's just a little, is that agitation, or is that like a subtle kind of agitation, or is that just like...
Well, if you're saying that there's a really rapid, almost vibratory quality to it, I wouldn't describe that as agitation necessarily. Of course, if you had a lot of caffeine or something, then then it might be a sort of physiological agitation that's superimposed on perception.
So there's no... as if there were subtle dullness, there's no flip side of subtle dullness on that kind of energy of the mind continuum, because you just have more and more moments of mind.
Well, as you have more and more perceiving mind moments, it all depends on what those moments are. It can manifest as a tremendous increase in clarity of perception. It can manifest as a lot of distraction, if there are a lot of distractions there, either way. Now, one of the things that can happen, and it does happen, you see, there are moments of consciousness whose object correspond to each of the different sensory fields, the six sensory fields. But there's a seventh kind of moment of consciousness, I call it a binding moment of consciousness, that we know. These are the moments that take the content of other moments of consciousness and integrate them and combine them in a meaningful way. In the very simplest sense, they're the ones that put what you see and what you hear together so that they make sense. But they also extract the contents of moments of other moments of consciousness in the ongoing stream, and they assemble them to make the ongoing story of what's happening moment by moment. Without those binding moments of consciousness, your conscious experience begins to degenerate into... I shouldn't say degenerate. It is a sort of degeneration in terms of the way we normally see. We normally have this really smooth kind of perception, because all these little moments are bound together in these binding moments, and this is what we're primarily conscious of, is the unfolding sequence of these binding moments of consciousness. And it gives us this impression of continuity and flow and everything. Because that's one part of your mind is integrating the information as it goes along. When those start to drop out, you start to become conscious in a way you usually are not of the individual moments of consciousness that they've actually been, that they've been assembling together and integrating. And then things begin to take on a jerkiness or a vibratory quality. And that's actually a very good thing when it happens in meditation. It's a sign, it's something that's deliberately sought for sometimes in the practice, because it allows you to have insight into what's really going on. And this is where the moments of consciousness model that's described in the Abhidharma came from. Those meditators having this experience, realizing the significance of it, pursuing it in their meditation, and finding that it provided a key by which they could unlock the mysteries of how the mind works and how, you know, what's actually going on in the perceptual process. So if in your meditation you start to become aware of a fine sort of jerkiness, a vibratory quality, then I wouldn't describe that as an agitation, but rather as a far more refined perception. It usually comes as a result of examining a changing process very, very closely. So if you focus on the breath sensations, they're a changing process. And if you focus on them very, very closely, what happens is you begin to resolve those individual, not that you're necessarily resolving individual moments of consciousness, because they're a bit too fine for that. But you're resolving moments of consciousness at a much finer level than you ordinarily do. And as you go in closer and closer, looking for finer and finer detail, then there are fewer binding moments of consciousness. You become aware of that process. And so that's not a kind of agitation. As a matter of fact, when that happens, if you examine your mental state, it is very calm, it is very focused, and it is very, very clear. That's a different phenomenon altogether. Okay. Although I think it probably does have a little bit of similarity to what you might have with caffeine or amphetamines or something like that. I haven't tried either one of those things in a long time, so I'm not totally sure. The one other way that you might use the word agitation has to do with mental state. It's kind of an emotional agitation. And I'm sure you all know what that means. You come to a meditation and you're perturbed. You're worried about something, you're angry about something, you have a conflict about something, some decision to be made. And your mind is in an energized state, just in a restless state. And so it's moving around much more than it usually does. And because mental state and emotion is essentially the same thing. It's an emotion, and it feels agitated, and it feels disturbed. So that's the other kind of agitation. Yeah.
It's because you're kicking up against the question that I don't want to ask.
Oh.
I had that. You know, two things you said. One last night about the painful form of clarity, where you wish you could fuzz it out again, you wish you could zoom out.
Yeah.
And then the energized state of mind when agitation's there. Those two things combined really strongly in a session today. And I was looking for, I was doing my best to see that, yes, this is an old thing for me. I've tasted it before. This is a completely fresh, new experience. Yeah, I was still trying to find a way of dividing my attention so that everything wasn't just on. It was coming from my hearing that I was getting so agitated. I was saying, okay, well, there are other things. There is what I can feel. I opened my eyes up to take the sense of the hearing down a notch.
Yeah,
right. I had strong, steady energy to watch my breath, but it was like a desperate energy. To back the clarity off of my hearing. And it was hard. I got really agitated.
But you did the right thing, trying to diffuse some of that energy into other sensory fields. The worst kind of agitation is when it's all thoughts and emotions. But still, the best thing to do with it is to try to redirect that excess energy into multiple channels. So take some of the pressure off whatever the one channel is. So you've had this before auditorily?
Yeah, as a musician, and also just I'm kind of wired towards my ears, I think, more than the others. Mm-hmm. So certain times it'll just pick up and amplify all the sounds in the room, which normally I was seeking to help keep me stay awake. Mm-hmm. It massively flipped over into agitating.
Is there a further question in that, or?
No, you were just ringing bells.
Ringing bells, okay. So. Any other questions about the relationship between agitation and dullness? Yes.
If a practitioner's level of concentration is such that they have a higher proportion of perceiving moments, do the people around them respond to them in any different way?
They may. We are sensitive to what's going on in each other in a lot of ways that we're not conscious of. And so it's quite possible that somebody might perceive that and react to it. Do you have a specific...
I'm wondering about the figure of the charismatic personality. I'm wondering if there's a correlation between the charismatic personality and this kind of awareness.
I really seriously doubt that there's any kind of correlation at all. As a matter of fact, I've learned a lot about charisma from talking to people, reading about it a little bit recently, and from Matthew Immergett, who some of you know, who teaches sociology of religion and is interested in these things. And it appears that charisma is actually something that is projected by the perceiver onto an individual, and then they will resonate that, but it really doesn't originate in the person who has the charisma. It originates in the people that project that charisma onto them. And then if they resonate with it and other people come into that resonance, then you have more and more people doing the same projection. And my understanding of it is there seems to be very little specifically identifiable about the person who has the charisma, whereas on the other hand, there are many identifiable characteristics about those who perceive that person as having charisma, or who are drawn to that person because of their charisma. Because if you look at people to whom charisma is attributed, you find a huge variety of personalities and ethical qualities and all kinds of other things. And so that's my thoughts on it. You meet somebody who's charismatic, you are making them charismatic. Or you meet somebody that's charismatic to everybody else and not charismatic to you, you know why. You haven't tuned into that thing. Anything else on this topic? All right. We've dealt with a few questions here. Well, there's one more we could deal with. Please explain the difference between creating merit and creating virtuous karma, and the difference between them in general. That's a great topic for discussion. What is merit? I don't know who asked this question, and it doesn't matter. Just anybody. What is merit?
When there is no self involved.
What's that?
it's a, one of my understanding that between karma and merit, merit when we selfless action.
Selfless action?
Right. Yeah. Nothing, when you expect nothing in return. So it doesn't apply to self, which is a...
Well, a selfless action, yes. If a selfless action would be an action that reinforces selflessness.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, because whatever action, whatever intention that comes from, that drives an action, has a powerful formative effect on us. And if it comes from a place of selfishness, it makes us more selfish. If it comes from a place of selflessness, it makes us more selfless, which would mean that it's moving you out of that place of attachment to self-view and other aspects of delusion. It would mean that it's an action that is rooted in generosity rather than personal desire, or in love and compassion rather than aversion and hatred and so forth. So what you are calling merit then would be something that weakens the hold of craving on us. Now that's exactly what I would describe as good karma.
No.
Yeah, right? No.
Okay.
All right, so maybe somebody else has, what's the difference between merit and virtuous karma? Yeah.
Virtuous karma is directly linked to enlightenment, while the accumulation of merit gives you positive tools within samsara.
Yes.
Towards the next lifetime, maybe, or the ones ahead.
Merit gives you a tool to use.
To use within samsara itself, but it won't take you out of samsara. It's virtue that will.
Yes, right. That's right. What will take you out of samsara is the good karma that you create. As I defined good karma last night. Because, so merit, yes, I would agree with that. Merit is a tool. I wonder if you're thinking of it in the same way I am.
Probably not, but let's try.
Well, let's find out. Because, okay, to me, if I think of merit as a tool in this way, is that a person, let's say I know about the concept of karma, and I'm inclined to have this wish to make good karma for myself. And I've been told that, well, if you do good acts, good things will happen to you. Right?
But that's lacking renunciation.
What's that?
Lacking renunciation. You're doing it
That's
out
right.
of a selfish type
You're
of
thing. Doing it out of a selfish place. Mm-hmm. And now merit gives me a tool to work on that. Okay, so I say, okay, I find when I do these good things, I can't forget the fact that I'm going to have a benefit from these. And so I'm really... making my good karma bad because I'm interposing the selfish. So to me, merit is precisely the tool where you form the intention not to be the beneficiary of this good act, but rather to have, well, to have it go to someone else or to all beings or whatever. But the thing is to form the intention that you not be the beneficiary. So it's a way of removing that little, that tinge of selfishness that is otherwise so hard to remove. That's exactly what I see, merit. Yeah. That's how you see it?
Not so black and white. Huh. I was seeing merit as cleaning up the action a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it was a purely clean action, it would be virtuous already.
Yes, that's right.
So it's just a reminder of a goal that allows us to focus a little better.
It's a tool.
Yeah.
But every time, to the degree to which we hold the intention to transfer the merit of a virtuous act to someone else as the beneficiary. We're cleaning it up a little bit. We're making in that moment, we're making a good karma. It's a karma of unselfishness. So it's a tool. Yeah, that's exactly what I see it as. Of course, it also gets turned into a different kind of a tool. Right? You want to make lots of merit? Give money to the temple. I'll get into that aspect of it. That's the relationship that I see. That exactly. But you know, you're not. To exercise merit, you have to have already had this awareness of the selfishness that creeps into your good actions. So you're keeping precepts, and why are you keeping the precepts? Sometimes it's hard to have the real purpose of the precepts in mind, which is to bring about a purification that is necessary for your own awakening. And so then any idea like merit can be used as a tool to help bring you back to that focus. Yeah.
I was thinking before of what you were saying of doing something and the intention has some sort of selfishness involved in it,
mm-hmm.
And that making it not a good karma.
Yeah.
I don't know if I disagree on that, whether it makes it like good or bad, but I was thinking that as just like a starting point,
mm-hmm.
and like similar to what we were talking about last night, and you were saying that everything we do is because it seems right at the moment. And I disagree, but I don't know if I want to say doing something with an iota of selfishness is still good if it's like a good action, but not so bad, because that's just like the starting mm-hmm. point, and then maybe your view gets refined a little further and like mm-hmm. a little further. So maybe starting to meditate or whatever because you want to feel good or something,
mm-hmm.
and you start to understand the motivation changes. I guess I see it maybe as less black and white.
Well, I certainly agree with you. There's all kinds of reasons that we can have for doing something, and our motivations may not be pure. But to whatever degree there is some positive motivation in that, then we're going to reap the consequences of that. Not only that, the acts that we do have their own consequences, quite apart from the karma that's associated with them. So you might practice generosity in order to look good in the eyes of someone else. But the act itself still has its positive, beneficial consequences. Whereas, in that particular instance, it's a completely selfish act, and it's bad. It's just plain bad karma because you're reinforcing your own self-attachment, your own desires, and so on and so forth. In it. Somebody might decide to meditate because they notice there's lots of cute women that meditate. There's nothing particularly edifying about that motivation. On the other hand, it puts them in the meditation class and they begin to do the practice. And that sets a whole different process in motion. There's a good that comes from the act that's quite apart from the intention. And of course, after a few weeks, their intention in continuing to meditate is coming from a completely different place. So it's been transformed. I think this is something that it's a really important thing to recognize, that we start where we are. We have to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps. And if you examine it honestly, most of your motivations that have involved you in getting involved with the Dharma definitely had a selfish component. May still have a selfish component. But the point is that there's a transformation that can be taking place as well. And eventually, it can become a very pure kind of motivation. So we start where we are. We want to become awakened so that we can be free from suffering. But there's a certain point in our spiritual evolution where we've long ago left behind the notion of a self that needs to be freed from suffering. So this is the evolutionary process. We start where we are. Yeah.
It seems to me that our ability to empathize with other people's perspectives would be greatly lessened if we were just suddenly virtuous in our motivation. We wouldn't be like the worst teachers I've ever met are the ones who just understood things in one instant. Or naturals, people who are naturals, seem to be, in my experience, the worst teachers. The ones that I've gotten the most from have gone through all the notches and all the different parameters of experience and have been able to see and empathize with all the different kinds of dispositions of their students and say, oh no, I see where you're coming from. It's not just this lofty thing.
That's
exactly
right.
Like if there were no steps, if there were no metrics, then so many people would be left behind. And I think that maybe retroactively, as our selfish motivation gradually gets weaned, we can still use those motivations to empathize with other people who we're mingling with.
I agree with you totally. Yeah. If it comes too easily, you have no idea how to teach it.
Yeah.
How do you teach somebody else that it doesn't come easily to succeed, to achieve the same thing? So
I'm still curious. I still don't understand the difference between merit and virtue.
The difference between merit and virtue? Well, it depends on, I suppose, on how you're looking at it. If you're speaking in terms of a meritorious act and a virtuous act, if you're describing that act as meritorious because it involves the dedicating of merit to others, then it is virtuous. There's no difference at all. Right? The difference, I think, comes where you are behaving in a virtuous way for a complex of mixed emotions. And so the act itself may belong in the category of virtuous, but the motivations are mixed. See what I'm saying there? And then merit, that's where merit becomes the tool to make the motivations behind the virtuous act themselves more virtuous.
So merit is only a mental disposition. It's not an action.
It's a mental disposition, yeah. Merit is the dedication. Yeah, I don't think we ever really actually said what merit to the definition of it. Merit is the dedication of the good consequences that come to you from something to someone else in order to remove the taint of selfishness from it. That's how I would describe it.
I see merit as being something valuable and worthwhile.
What's that?
I see merit as being something valuable and worthwhile that someone has achieved, maybe through virtue, through acting virtuous.
Well, that's another way of using the term merit again. That's still another way.
Then you can dedicate it.
That's kind of a different way. So merit is something that you've accumulated of value. Right? And what is it that you've accumulated of value?
Well,
maybe you save somebody's life.
You save somebody's
life. And the person went on to be the king of some country and helped many people.
Mm-hmm. You save somebody's life and good things come from that. But let's see, we would, as sort of social standard, we would say that the person has acquired merit for having done a good act.
That too.
Is that what you're talking about?
Partly.
Okay. So that's essentially, that's what saying, that's what the rest of us think of you for saving this person's life. We think more highly of you. So that's a value that we attribute to you because of the thing you did. Okay. Yeah. And of course, you can like being looked in that way, so you can go around trying to find things that people approve of to do so that you are seen as having more and more merit.
But it's not really merit unless it benefits others.
Well, then in this other sense that we're talking about, it's not all that virtuous anymore. You're doing a lot of good things, but you're doing them for a reason that in itself is not particularly virtuous.
But they're worthwhile to other people.
The actions themselves have worthwhile consequences. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And that's one of the important things that I think gets lost when people simplify causality too much. Is when I come from the perspective of early Buddhism. I don't come from a Hindu perspective. I don't come from any later Buddhist perspective. From the early Buddhist perspective, there's a clear distinction between an act and the consequences of the act and the intention behind the act and the consequences of that intention on the person who acted out of that intention. So those two things are very different. So every act has its own consequences. And in order to act out of good intention, we have to do the best job that we can of evaluating what the consequences of the act itself will be. And we make mistakes. We do things out of good intentions that bring unfortunate consequences, right? Sometimes we even do things with malevolent intentions that produce good consequences. Which just goes to show that when it comes to predicting the consequence of an act, it's extremely difficult. But nevertheless, we try to make the best prediction of the consequences of the act. But the consequences of the act are quite a different thing than what's going on inside of us. And so, if we're kind and generous, one of the consequences of being, well, of course, one of the consequences of being kind and generous is that other people are going to be benefited by our kindness, and other people are going to be benefited by our generosity. Another consequence of the act itself is that being seen by others to be kind and generous means that we will probably also be the recipients of kindness and generosity. We'll be treated with kindness and generosity as well. Although there's no guarantee of that. But there's a high probability. I mean, that's the way the world works. That's just simply a consequence of the action. It has absolutely nothing to do with our intentions. Our intentions could be of the noblest or the least noble sort. And they have nothing to do. The consequences of the act are unrelated to the consequences upon us of our intention. And that's what the Buddha talked about when he said, when I say karma, I mean intention. Because as I mentioned the other night, the word karma literally means action. And it had, over a long period of time, come to mean an action with moral consequences on the person who performed the action. So you might give money to somebody, and the act of giving money to somebody helps the person you gave it to. But there was this idea that there was going to be a further consequence of the action that was going to come back on you. So that maybe in your next life you'd be born in a wealthy family or something like that. And this was the idea of karma. This was the definition of karma prior to the Buddha, is that it was actions that had moral consequences, moral in the sense of good or bad, beneficial or unbeneficial, wholesome or unwholesome, on the person that performed the act. And the Buddha took this notion, and looking more deeply, having a much deeper understanding of human nature and the human mind and the way it worked, he said, I'm going to use this term differently. When I say karma, I'm referring specifically to the intention behind the action. So each act has its own consequences, but the intention has a separate consequence that operates within the person. So if you perform an action out of selfish intentions, out of craving, out of malice, out of hatred, out of ignorance and delusion, these have a consequence on you. The consequence they have on you is they make you more subject to the same delusion. Every time you act out of the same delusion, you bury yourself deeper in that delusion. You reinforce it. Every time you act out of craving, you are more likely to act in a similar way out of the same craving in a future time. Every time you exercise aversion or hatred, then you make yourself into a more hateful and averse person. And all of this is going to come back to you in terms of suffering, because remember, he'd already said the cause of suffering is craving, and craving is really rooted in delusion. So anything that you do to yourself that strengthens delusion and craving is going to produce more suffering for you. So he said, when I say karma, I mean intention, and that intention is going to come back to you in the form of further suffering. So you see, there's this really neat separation. We have the act in the world, and it has its own consequences. People may be nice to you because of what you did. People may esteem you. You may receive great merit, respect, affection from other people because of the good things that you did. But that's quite apart from what's going on inside of you. And if you did it out of unselfish motives, if you did it out of generosity, love, compassion, any of these more virtuous motivations, you have made yourself into a person who is, to some degree or another, is going to be less vulnerable to suffering in the future, and who's actually moved a step closer to the liberation, to the awakening. And so karma has these internal consequences, and actions have these external consequences. Now, we're still left, when you do an act, you have a good intention, I really want to help this person here, and I think, you know, I see how much he's suffering, so obviously the best thing I can do is give him the drink he needs. We make mistakes. We don't always do the act that's going to have the best consequences, but it doesn't matter. The consequences of the act are not the same thing as the consequences on me performing the act. If I did it purely out of the goodness of my heart, out of concern for the other person, I will reap the positive consequences of that. So there's this difference, this important distinction between the act and the intention. Yeah.
So are the new schools of Buddhism trying to bring the two levels, the acts in the words, the consequences of the physical acts and the intentions together? Is it a new type of, or relatively more recent type of school that is trying to bring them together? Because I more frequently heard that there is some kind of intersection between the two, although it's not, you know, unilaterally consequential. There is still some overlap between the two levels.
Can you repeat his question?
Yeah, what I really can you be more specific about which new schools and which different version of?
Well, for instance, in the Mahayana tradition, the actions and the intentions are two separate entities, but the action itself, it's still, if it's good, it's still going to bring back to you good consequences on the material level as well, even if the intention is not necessarily perfect. Of course, the intention has its own big weight, maybe more than the actual performing of the action, but the action also has its weight on your own well-being in the future, or this or future lives. So they're not entirely separate.
Well, depending on how this is interpreted, to really discuss this, we have to have a clear understanding of emptiness. Because that has a great impact on how we interpret the consequences of action and karma. But just in a simpler framework, one of the things that we don't want to do is we don't want to slip into magical thinking. We don't want to slip into the idea that there is going to be a consequence of an action that reflects back on a person that is not in every way consistent with the laws of causality. So, like things like the secret, which is taught, which this is a very kind of New Age idea, and it says that if you give money away, you'll get money, right? Or if you visualize this house that you want, that you'll find yourself in this big beautiful house that you want. Things like that. There's a kind of magical thinking in there, and we don't want to slip into that. We want to stay in the place where we understand, you know, one of the things that the Buddha taught, dependent origination, was that everything, except of course for the realization of ultimate truth, is everything is a result of causes and conditions, and everything exerts effects. Everything is in itself a cause of other things. And so the laws of causality need to be honored and appreciated. So we won't get into magical thinking, but we can see that your positive and your negative actions are going to produce effects that reflect back on you in this life, obviously. They're not entirely predictable. The universe is too complex. It's not that simple that if you give money away, you're going to be rich. If it did, well, I think you know, it just doesn't work that way, right? If it worked that way, then it means if you steal money, that sooner or later everybody's going to steal all your money. And that doesn't happen. You look at a lot of people who have stolen a lot of people's other people's money, and they die very rich. But then there's another thing too, though. If somebody undertakes to act in an ethical and virtuous way, even though it is for contaminated reasons, it's going to begin to have an effect on them. So if you begin to practice generosity, even though initially the generosity may be with some reluctance, it's going to have an effect on you to the degree that you have some goodness in your heart. Some of that is going to be genuine generosity. And that is a good karma. And you've made that good karma, and it's going to increase your predisposition to generosity. So you can learn generosity. So you're going to, even though your intention may not be pure, the actions themselves can eventually alter your intentions. All of these things are interconnected. Yeah.
Maybe in terms of this question, could you talk a little bit about the five niyamas?
About this?
The five niyamas?
The five niyamas, the five levels of causality that the Buddha describes. Very good idea. These are the physical, the biological, the mental, the karmic, and the fifth level is dharma, dhamma niyama, dharma causality. Physical causality, this is like physics and chemistry. This is what scientists study. It's every action has an equal and opposite reaction. What goes up must come down. All these other things. The laws of the universe that are studied and described, and by means of which we can fly to the moon, build computers, and do all kinds of things. We can look back in time and see what the state of the universe was 20 billion years ago. It's all kinds of wonderful things that we do through the application of our understanding of the laws of physical causality. And we see that one of the interesting things that's happened in this world of ours is that the laws of physical causality, of physics and chemistry, have given rise to a phenomenon that isn't itself purely physical. It's biology, life. And this is one of the things we've learned, is that it wasn't that long ago that to understand life, we postulated some sort of invisible force that somehow infused matter and made it living and left it when it died and so forth. But now we have this really beautiful, clear understanding that biology actually comes from physics and chemistry. And biological causality says that acorns grow into oak trees, not saguaro cactuses. Biological causality gives us this whole intricate, beautiful, living world that we live in, and it has its own laws. So that's a level of causality that arises from the physical, right? Make sense? And of course, genetics and all these things, they really allowed us to understand this level of causality. Of all the living things that have come into existence in this universe, some of them have minds. They have nervous systems and they have minds. And so they have behavior. They have behavior that is described on the basis of yet another level of causality that isn't obvious in the two preceding levels. You call it psychology or mental causality. Mice behave in a particular way. And when you know a bit about mouse psychology, you can make mice behave the way that you want to. Every kind of living thing with a mind behaves in ways that are a reflection of this mental level of causality. And so, you know, we can call that psychology, I guess. Mental causality. Now, of all of those living things with minds, there are a very few. As a matter of fact, we sometimes think we may be the only one. You know, most of the behavior of a mouse or a lizard or a deer is programmed in, it's hardwired in. It was actually determined in the genetic code, and it manifests as a result of chemical reactions. So there's this cascade of causality that causes lizards to behave in a very highly predictable way. And it's very difficult to train lizards to do something different. It's hard to get your pet lizard to fetch the newspaper. There are other organisms like dogs and horses that you can train. You can modify their behaviors, but they're not really self-modifying. Human beings, on the other hand, are really self-creating, self-programming entities. From the level of mental causality, for sure in human beings, who knows what other kinds of minds may exhibit this level of causality. But this is the level of karmic causality. We create ourselves. Karma is the intentions. We shape ourselves. We mold ourselves. We're all different. We all continuously change. We can become better, we can become worse. We can become more ignorant and more trapped in delusion, or we can become awakened and attain wisdom. We can act out of the primitive drives that we're born with and divert those drives to more and more sophisticated forms of behavior, but they're still coming from craving. Or we can actually uproot craving. We can free ourselves totally from craving. We can be at the mercy of the suffering that craving creates, or we can liberate ourselves from that suffering through overcoming craving, through transcending it. Karmic causality provides for a whole new level of causality in the universe, of self-programming, self-creating, self-directing beings who can transform themselves totally. You can transform yourself into a demon, or you can transform yourself into a Buddha. That's the karmic level of causality. Out of the karmic level of causality, by exercising the karmic level of causality, through the exercise of the laws of chemistry, biology comes into existence. Through the exercise of genetic laws and evolution and so forth, mental causality comes into existence. From that arises the karmic. From the karmic causality comes the level of causality that we would call dharma. It's causality that's a reflection of the ultimate truth, the ultimate nature of reality. And so those are the five niyamas, those are the five levels of causality. And so we're especially concerned here with what we were talking about earlier, is the distinction between karmic causality and physical and chemical and biological and psychological causality. I can do good things, and as a result of mental causality, psychological causality, other human beings will say, oh, isn't he a great guy? And I can feel really good. And I can do that for all kinds of selfish reasons. So we see the interaction of all these different levels of causality. Yes?
Okay. Sorry. Okay, so I have a question based on the question. Mm-hmm. So, because I wrote the question, so I feel like I'm kind of going around, we're skirting around it, and I don't, mm-hmm. it's just not clicking yet for
me. Yeah, okay.
And this is, maybe this is something that made me ask the question, you know, talking about virtuous actions, creating good karma, I mean, that also relies on a sense of self, in a way, mm-hmm. but there is no self. So anyway, so like when we do a dedication, you know, yeah. we dedicate the merit accumulated here to the benefit of all beings.
Yes.
So I guess part of me was saying, well, what's the difference? I hear it here and there.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm like, are people using them interchangeably, or is this thing called merit? You know, reach enlightenment from the combination of the accumulation of merit and wisdom. I'm trying to find the fine line between what is merit and what's just good karma.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, and yeah. I'm not sure if sometimes they're being used interchangeably or if they are. I've heard some people saying, oh, no, that's not good karma. That's merit. Or, oh, that, you know,
like. So I'm. Well, I do think sometimes they're being used interchangeably and sometimes they're being used to mean something different. But as you say, I see what you mean. It's not clicking in. This, like so many things, can be understood on different levels. From a very simple level of lay people in Buddhist countries, merit is a teaching that helps to guide them in their behavior and helps to resolve in them some of the internal conflicts that they might experience with, you know, just simply knowing I want to be a good person and I do these things, but I know that they're going to benefit me, and somehow that makes it feel wrong and I'm confused about this. And so merit is an idea that can be used at a very simple level to help a person sort this out, you know. And that's sort of how I think we originally addressed it when we first, you know, we talked about it as a tool. But at another more sophisticated level, when we dedicate the merit of what we do here today to the benefit of all beings, at a more sophisticated level, we're recognizing that our separate selfhood, our individuality, is an illusion, and that the good karma we make isn't really my good karma for me, because that me doesn't even exist.
Right.
And so it's like, it's a reminder that the law of karma, causality, applies, but it transcends the illusory person. And so we can think of, you know, I'm making good karma for me, you know, and maybe I'll get enlightened in this lifetime. But it's reminding us that really that perception is an illusion, that no person gets enlightened.
Right. Because sometimes karma is the problem, you know. Like.
Yeah. So in that sense, it's almost like saying, you know, well, there's really no such thing as good personal karma. It's all merit. You know, and so all the merit that we all the merit that we derive from our meditation and practice and study and everything else like that, it doesn't belong to us. It could never belong to us because there's nobody there for it to belong to.
Right.
So I think a lot of the contradictory ways that sometimes the terms are used synonymously and sometimes they mean something different, to really sort it out is you have to know the level of understanding at which the person using it is at, or at least is communicating at that point. Certainly, merit is a slippery word, and you know, there is no merit in accumulating merit for yourself. And that makes it puzzling. Yeah.
You've spoken several times about what you termed meta-consciousness. And if I understood correctly...
Metacognitive.
Yeah. Which kind of bears the same relation to awareness that awareness bears to attention.
Yeah, you could say that. Mm-hmm.
And so that from the perspective of metacognition, all observations by awareness are, in fact, viewed as actions of the mind.
Observations of awareness are actions.
By awareness of attention are viewed as operations of mind of awareness.
Exactly.
So if that's the case, doesn't that sort of lay low all of these fine distinctions about systems of causality and virtue versus merit and so on? From the perspective of the metacognitive, all of these are equally actions of the mind.
I'm not sure. Do they? Maybe it's an interesting idea. So from a metacognitive perspective...
It's all, as my grandmother would say, it could be shav or it could be borscht, but it's all cabbage.
Well, from the metacognitive perspective, you see, it's a metacognitive perspective that you would do the practice, from which you would do the practice of Mahamudra. And in the practice of Mahamudra, you would see that the nature of all of the objects arising in consciousness are mind itself. And then, when that matured, you would really, you know, you say, oh, okay, everything is just mind. And it's, oh, mind is just like this. Mind, too, is just something that's arising in mind. Yeah. So in that regard, yes, from the metacognitive perspective, you realize that this truth, that all you've ever known, all you ever can know, is just the mind doing its own thing. Yeah. So that's true. But, you see, there's another important difference, that the physical and the biological and the mental levels of causality acknowledge that the mind isn't all there is. And then what do we mean by mind? You see, if you think my mind is all there is, then you've slipped into solipsism, which is a terrible thing. And if, from a metacognitive perspective, as you observe, something becomes very clear. The smell of a rose may arise. The experience of blue may arise. And these the nature of these is mental, but something outside of my mind gave rise to it. Now, we can take all kinds of different points of view on what that is outside of my mind that gave rise to them. The one thing that we can know for sure from a metacognitive perspective is that it's unknowable. All the mind can know is its own content. But there's something that's triggering certain kinds of content. But you'll never know what it is. Now, one of the things that's happened historically is in early Buddhism there was a tendency to say, okay, there's an unknowable material world, and then there's an unknowable continuum of becoming that is mental in nature. And so from one or other of these two places is where everything that I experience comes from. So I have blue or the smell of rose, it's coming from this material realm. I have a thought or a feeling or a memory, or I'm able to create an imaginary image in my mind. And it's coming from this continuum of becoming, this mental realm. And later on, the Yogi Charans said, you know, that's unknowable, this is unknowable, let's put them behind the same curtain and we'll call it the Alaya. And so they combined the mental, and they said, we don't even know if they're separate. They might be the same. Unfortunately, there was a branch in there that kind of got off track. We wanted to say that, you know, that instead of staying in a nice place of agnosticism, the material doesn't exist at all. And blue and rose happen the same way they happen when you go to sleep at night and have a dream. It's all coming from mind. And that doesn't really work. That's the flip side of materialism. The materialists would say, let's behind this, they too put everything behind the same screen, the same way that the Yogacharans did. They call that screen, the physical universe. And they say, mind, that's just something that matter does. Right? It's just a behavior of matter. And these types of monism, whether it's this idealism that throws material out and materiality out the window, or whether it's the idealism or the materialism that throws the mind out the window. They both have their own pitfalls and they lead into their own really messy places. A much more useful approach is the non-dualistic that says, whatever's behind the curtain, it doesn't need to be two different things, but it doesn't need to be one or the other. It can be two different ways of the human mind, of the individual mind, experiencing the same thing. So you look at the coin from this side, it's mind. You look at it from that side, it's matter. But it's the same coin, it's not something different. So these are different ways of approaching this philosophically. What a clear understanding of that does is it spares us from falling into nihilism, that, oh my God, nothing exists. There is no material world. All these people are just figments in our imagination. I just made you up. Or, you know, or the nihilism is nothing exists. Solipsism is nothing exists except me. And they're both really bad places to be. So that's a really important thing about the five niyamas, that they give everything. They respect things at a different level and allows a place for the individual mind to have its own relative reality. And the absolute in its, now this goes beyond what I've discussed to you now, but when you understand where this leads, the absolute is an indivisible unity. All divisions are imposed by mind. By individual life. Does that make sense to you? Yeah.
So what you were talking earlier, and you were saying that it's not just blue, the color blue or whatever is just coming, it's coming from something, but it's unknowable. That division between the unknowable and that which is knowing is imposed, and it's not there as well.
But that division is...
You just said the absolute, there's all these divisions are imposed by individual human minds.
Yes, exactly.
So that division that you spoke about before between some kind of
perceiver... The knowable and the unknowable. That
looking for something that's throwing things out, that division is...
Comes from the mind. Yeah, yeah, right. Doesn't come from absolute.
It's not existing.
It comes from the individual, yeah. An interesting idea associated with this is that a mind is, you ever heard the term ego tunnel? it's like a perspective within the absolute. And with the passage of time, it moves through it, and there's this little tunnel. And from within the ego tunnel, all you know is the walls of the tunnel. So, yes, probably kind of we should wrap this up tonight. I think we've got into an interesting area of discussion. Would you like to continue this tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay. And I'd like you to challenge me with your question. I want you to leave with as much clarity and understanding as we can obtain through interchange of information in this medium. And I want you to keep in mind what we're doing. All your mind can ever know is the models that it creates. So we are making and we're sharing models. And we're trying to create and share a model that is going to serve us in the best possible way. And so in this process, what you need to ask yourself is do I understand this? Is this serving my needs? Is this model that we're discussing, is it going to be useful and be a basis for me to grow and deepen my understanding? And so when you challenge me, then we refine the model in your mind so that it has that effect. That's what we're trying to do. And you already have models in your mind. Some you created yourself, some somebody else has put there. And there's a very good simile that comes from the sutras on this, that it's as though in our journey we've come to a stream and flood. It's a raging flood. We want to get to the far shore. The far shore is realization, awakening, Buddhahood. To cross that stream, because of the kind of beings we are, we need a raft, right? And so we're going to construct a raft, and we're going to try to construct the raft that is going to work best to get us to the other side. We'll try not to get bogged down in questions like, is it better to make the raft out of these kinds of pieces or that, except in terms of what works best. Okay? If you were building a raft, that would be the only criteria that we would construct it out of the sticks and boards and branches and whatever is available. What's going to work best? We're looking at the river, we know what our needs are, we're going to create the raft that's going to get us where we're trying to go. And we'll try not to waste our time worrying about what color to paint the raft, or what color flag to hang on it, things like that. That's not important. How many angels can dance on the head of the tent? That doesn't matter. And the other thing is, we'll remember that the purpose of the raft is to get us to the other side. And once we've gotten to the other side, there won't be any need at all to carry this raft with us. We can dump it, it served its purpose. With any luck, when we dump it in the river, it will go back to the other side and somebody else who's looking for one can use it. Mm-hmm. Right? And as a matter of fact, when we're making our raft, we we have other graphs that have been used before available to help us in the process. We don't necessarily have to build them from scratch. But let's not forget that it's still a utilitarian structure. And its whole purpose is to get us across the stream. So we'll continue tomorrow with that in mind, all right? Go ahead and take a break. And there's 32 minutes left on the clock. So I'm going to go to the washroom, and she's now going to the washroom, and come back, and we'll sit together till the bell rings, all right?